Before we start on the analytic part proper, I want to give you one example of the current state of the demo programs, because I'd already been conferring with my TA, Mattia, about implementing the stuff on the observatory computers, which will probably happen in the course of this week, so that we can start next week, so that everybody will have this access to this. I'll give you one example and try to make direct connection between what we have said before the break. What I have here is a circular disk. The computer has been arranged in such a way that the screen acts like a trackball, so if I put the mouse somewhere over here, keep the mouse button depressed, I can just rotate this in space. But you can see that this is a disk that has a certain finite thickness. Then another thing that is new, I've added an opportunity for you to put in a tracker particle. That is, it happens to be this one over here. Just you can take any particle in the complete distribution. And I've programmed things in such a way that it leaves a trail behind so that you can see what the consequences are for an individual star of this particular dynamics. Now, for the rest, most of the distributions are made in such a way that they are Poissonian. That is to say, a point is put down according to a certain probability procedure, but that is it, right? And there's no distances being kept from point to point. So every now and then you see particles like here, where two of them appear to be relatively close together in space, or even three such as here, or four such as here. And this is natural, right? There is a saying in the Netherlands, een ongeluk komt nooit alleen, and that is a consequence of Poissonian statistics. Now, as you will see when I switch on the time, this has drastic consequences. This type of initial conditions has drastic consequences for the future. Because you can see, just as there are over-densities here due to pure randomness, there are under-densities elsewhere also due to pure randomness. And of course, in the regions where the density is high, you expect the time step to be small and the evolution to be drastic, and the converse is true in the empty places over here. So whereas the overall distribution over here is cylindrically symmetric and is mirror symmetric with respect to the equatorial plane, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to remain this way. The computations are started and stopped, the time, sorry, is started and stopped by pressing the space bar. So when I press the space bar over here, you can see that this whole thing starts to rotate, and you see that your tracker particle over here is starting to follow its motion through space. Already you can see, like here for instance, and here, that the high density regions evolve much more quickly than the overall distribution in general. Right? And at this moment, if you were to stop for an instant, which is nice because you can play God in these things, you can see that this distribution is already strongly non-Poissonian. This is not just simply due to randomly putting down points, because there are many more high density clumps and many more voids over here than you would otherwise have thought. Right? And this only gets worse as time progresses. In this particular case, I have chosen an initial velocity distribution that is Keplerian, in the sense that you have circular orbits, or almost circular orbits, with this given density distribution. As time progresses, you see that the higher density regions coalesce and form fewer high density regions with more members. Okay, and that also, there is a saying associated with that which is rather biblical, to whom those that have shall be given. And the reason for this, of course, we already understand. The reason for this is on the blackboard. It is this 1 over r behavior, which you see in practice here. Okay, make r small, and your evolution time gets quick. Make r small, and your acceleration becomes large. Make r small, and these concentrations here become greedier and greedier, as it were. You will see, incidentally, that this individual tracker particle over here by no means follows the original circular orbit in which it was placed. Right? When you try and look at it from the side a little bit, you see that it literally worms its way through the distribution over here. And even though, on the average, this whole thing progresses like the cylindrical disk that it started out as, it no longer maintains this position in the long run. So, from here, you can already predict what is going to happen in the very, very, very long run. In the very long run, everything is going to coalesce into one blob with maybe a few particles escaping to infinity, right? Because, of course, one of the other interesting properties of the 1 over r behavior is that it has a horizontal asymptote. In other words, it is possible to get above it. It is possible to get an energy such that you escape from the entire system, just as like you can escape from an individual particle. Interestingly enough, if you were to follow something like this, you will see that if I were to put a line around an aggregate like this, it already starts to behave more or less like an individual object. Right? So the fragmenting that you see here is a true physical consequence of this 1 over r behavior that you see here. By the way, since we discussed technical sides of these things before the break, all these computations in this particular approximation are done by the leapfrog method. I've given in the programming the user the opportunity to use the Hermite method, which is very, very much jumpier, as it were, because you have these various timescales involved. And therefore, for simulations like this, which really show you a movie, this is not really quite so very suitable. Well then, I don't want to take the time until this thing has sort of equilibrated, but you can already see just simply with your eyes and with your sort of visual understanding that the characteristic timescale for a high-density aggregate such as this one can be very, very short compared with the overall timescale for the system as a whole, right? And there again, this range of timescales is implicit in the 1 over r behavior, but it also means that a large-scale system like this can have an evolutionary timescale that is surprisingly long. It will take surprisingly long to equilibrate, as it were. And that immediately raises the question, what precisely do you mean by equilibrium? We already saw in the very, very first lecture that equilibrium is not expected to occur, because, of course, in this particular case, 1 over r doesn't allow an equilibrium, but still you can perhaps talk about it. There is a certain thermality about concentrations like this and like that, a certain randomness. Just to conclude, since I have it over here, let me see if I can show you the behavior of such an individual orbit in order to impress on you how complicated this can get. So this is the individual trajectory of one of the stars that is sort of I just picked it at random and just gave it a number out of the 400 particles that are in this simulation over here. I can already see that this is relatively complicated, which points in the direction of randomness as a useful concept. Right. These are not regular orbits. These are not sort of nice, predictable thing. These are, to a certain extent, even chaotic, even though with the word chaotic you have to be careful because in dynamics it has a very specific meaning. Well then, the question now before us is, can we say global things about this kind of behavior? And the answer is yes, provided that we skip away from these practical things that we've shown so far to the more theoretical side of things in terms of probability distributions, which is what we're going to do right now. The approach that is taken in the textbook is very formal and very general. They talk about Lagrangian systems and Hamiltonian systems, and I presume that most of you have dealt with this during their lectures on classical mechanics. In order to remain sort of clear and to stay relatively close to observables, I'm not going to do that. Right. I mean, I'm going to just simply talk about position and velocity, whereas in actual Hamilton theory, you can be a little bit more general than that. Right. But I'm not really going to try and do this in very much detail. Well then, if we were to remove everything that pertains to the practical side of things, we generate a lot of space in which to do the analytic work. And as you will see again and again and again, we will be coming back to the 1 over r behavior of the individual potential of individual particles. We must keep doing this right up to the point that other physical effects will be taken into account, such as tidal interactions between stars. Well, since it is these quantities, position and velocity, that play a key role, and since we do observe absolute accelerations, ultimately, as I already explained, due to the effects of relativity, it makes a certain amount of sense to describe any mechanical system purely in terms of a distribution of its positions and its velocities. Those, because they are not observable properties of individual particles, are things that you have to give extra, that you have to give from the outside, either as initial conditions in a numerical computation or else as an overall description of a many-body system. What we will be doing from now is, in our minds, think not about individual particles, but about an ensemble of particles, a large number out of which every single one is merely a representative. And since it is the position and the velocity that play these key roles in the dynamical system, or the generalization thereof in Hamiltonian theory, but as I have already mentioned, I will abstract from that, what we can try and do is draw up a space which is going to be six-dimensional, where in three directions we plot the position and in the other three directions we plot the velocity of particles. And every given particle in the system is then a dot in that six-dimensional space. Now, let me warn you straight at the start about something that just about everybody, including myself, I've been thinking about and struggling with and all that. Wouldn't it be nice if we could treat these two coordinates on an equal footing? And the answer is we cannot. Right? This is a so-called symplectic space. It comes from a Greek word which means to weave together, to fold together. And it is not possible to devise a distance recipe in such a space. Right? You just measure velocities with one particular variable and you measure distances with another. And there is no single distance recipe that makes this homogeneous. Right? The practical consequences of this are very far-reaching, but I'm not really going to talk about that very much at this point. What we're going then to do is to describe a many, 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 many body system by a continuous function over this space. So I take a particular point here, and around that point I make a little box, and inside that box I will put a probability function, and that probability function just simply says how many points there are in a box with size delta x and delta v. I have, as you can see, suppressed the vectorial directions because it's impossible to draw a six-dimensional diagram on this particular blackboard. In the fully analytic theory, rather than using the velocity, people use almost always the momentum of the particles. And the reason, of course, for this is that you will want to accommodate the possibility that the points in this distribution do not always have the same, do not all have the same mass, right? I mean, for the moment, in order to connect with the previous discussion over here, I'll just simply pretend that they all have the same mass. The extra complication of this is something that we get to talk about later when we talk about the evolution of realistic stellar systems, in which we will see, in the long run, that yes, there is a drastic difference between systems where the particle masses are all the same and systems wherein the particle masses have a certain mass distribution. Let us now, first, before we do any algebra on this, think about the physics of the underlying situation. And again, I'm coming back to this 1 over R behavior over here. Let us consider. If we have a particle system where the only thing we have is a particle orbiting in a given potential, all this hullabaloo is basically superficial and unnecessary. Because once you have an overall potential and you have a particle in it, computing the orbit of that particle is straightforward. It may not be analytic like in the Keplerian solution or something like that, but we can do it. And that's not what we have here. We need still to bear in mind what our original goal was, and that is to say, come up with a self-consistency distribution, a stellar system where the potential in which an individual particle moves is the sum total of the potentials of all those individual particles, right? That means then that in this diagram, we're not just simply interested in the orbits of particles, right? I mean, if a particle in a system like this, in a potential, would have a harmonic oscillation about a given point, then its phase orbit would be totally simple, something like this. I mean, a harmonic oscillator is an ellipse in this particular kind of space. That's not what we have. What we have is a system where the particles interact, and as I had already shown when discussing the Barnes-Hutt oct tree, most of that interaction comes down to what happens on small length scales. Why? Because of the 1 over R behavior of the gravitational potential. Well then, if we were to see and ask, how does that work in this particular phase space, as it is called, then what we need to do is follow not just simply the orbit in phase space of a single particle, but the orbit in phase space of two particles, and ask about the interaction between them. And now we have a problem, basically. In the case that we have phase space theory in statistical mechanics, thermodynamics, statistical theoretical thermodynamics that some of you have had lectures in, effectively what we're using is that a particle in like a gas or in a liquid or something like that, but particularly in a gas, that's a good example, a particle moves freely until it physically hits another particle, right? You have an oxygen molecule in the air here, and it collides with a carbon dioxide molecule nearby or a nitrogen molecule, whatever. And they really don't know about each other's existence until they hit each other face on, bang. So it's all or nothing, as it were. And it is extremely local, extremely small scale. In other words, when you look at theories of the behavior of phase space in a thermodynamic system, a classical thermodynamic system such as a gas, first thing you notice is that interactions only take place at a given point, namely the point where the particles physically contact each other, where they physically collide. After the collision, then, which happens in a point in space that you can actually point at, it is here and not there, they jump to another position in velocity, but they remain in the same location. Just they connect, they collide, and then they scatter in different directions. So their velocities will be different after the collision. And it is behavior like this, with all those 10 to the infinity number of particles that you have in a gaseous system over here, that by and large people talk about. There are evolution equations for stuff like this. The so-called Boltzmann equation is an example. And then, however, Let us consider what that means in the case of a gravitational potential. Again, if this distance here, the interaction distance between the particles, is very, very small, then R is very, very small. And that means that the potential is very, very deep and the interaction is extremely violent. Already had that on the blackboard previously when I mentioned to you that small impact parameter collisions mean an extremely large deflection angle. That means then that if we were to do something like this in the case of actual stars, these jumps here in velocity will be very, very, very large. Already the sketch that I've given on the blackboard over here does not really do justice to the collisions of particles in a gas, where these jumps in velocity are relatively mild. In a gravitational system, however, these jumps are enormous for the very simple reason that they occur in a very, very small region of length, and therefore 1 over that very small number becomes a very big number. At the same time, there is a second consideration. And this is just what I've said to you now, is mostly a matter of R becoming small. However, if we look on the other side, there is basically no limit to R. It could be close to zero, it could be close to infinity. It is scale-free. There is no intrinsic physical length scale in a power law behavior. And that means then that overall, in the mean, for a stellar system, it is the large values of R and therefore the weak deflections that play a role. Ah, you might say, that's cool. We really want that, right? Because we start with a certain orbit and another orbit, and then the deflection here is relatively mild. But that's not the case. You can't have that. This deflection here cannot be located in a very small region of space. It must be in a very large region of space. So you get this sort of... Whereas the unperturbed orbit would have continued like this. The perturbed orbit is a little bit away, but the deflection stretches over a very large section of phase space over here. And similarly for this other particle that it interacts with. Now, that means then that this approximation, which is the underlier of the Boltzmann equation, is usually not the right one to take. You need something like this. So we have here the Boltzmann way of doing it. There is another way of approximately treating this, which is the so-called Fokker-Planck equation. But even that is, technically speaking, not completely applicable to an n-body gravitating system. So, having talked about the difficulties of the evolution of this system here, as I've talked about, that you cannot readily apply either of these methods to an n-body system, still it turns out that you can go surprisingly far in the case of n-body systems. You more or less know this just simply by looking at a stellar system. When you look at an elliptical galaxy, it looks so boring. It looks so calm. It looks so close to equilibrium. And you say, no matter how this system arranged it this way, you can still think that it is more or less equilibrium-like. So even though, for instance, this Boltzmann approximation is no longer valid, you could sort of hope that it approximately is. The question then before us is, how could we use this in an analytic description of such a system? And it all goes back to the behavior of this distribution function over here. As you know from probability theory, if you normalize this function in such a way that by definition the integral of f, the distribution function, over all of phase space equals unity, then it is fair to consider this as a probability distribution function. And you also know that then you can compute the expectation value of any quantity, I guess any quantity at all, no matter what function it is over here, you can expect the expectation value by computing the expectation value over all of phase space. Never mind what you want to take here. You can take the mean energy, you can take the mean momentum, blah, 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 never mind. And that is just simply because you have chosen this distribution to interpret it as a probability distribution by this normalization over here. Now, by and large, this is only a very small part of what one would be interested in. One would be interested in the evolution of such a system or in the behavior of these expectation values of whatever quantity it is that you want to derive. Looking at this from a distance, you might think that this is sort of a non-starter. And the example that I give to you here is something that, in fact, does occur in actuality. It's been predicted for a long time, but the observers took a long time before they could actually find a case in point. suppose that I take a cylindrical system like the one that I've just shown to you in the computer demo. And for my initial conditions, I'm going to take one system of particles that rotates in a counterclockwise way, and I superimpose on that an equal system of particles that rotates in a clockwise way. In principle, if there were no individual encounters between the particles, this could last forever. The particles in one half would go this way, the other half would go that way. Try that in a gas. You cannot do it. Try that in your swimming pool. You cannot do it. Because in that case, the system is collision dominated. The collisions with the individual particles determine the average dynamics of the whole. But in the case of a stellar system, in particular the stellar system like our galaxy where the star density is so low, this is not the case. Individual encounters are rare, and therefore you could in principle have a very long-lived system of this sort. We now know from... Excuse me, I did this wrong. Arrow should go this way, of course. My apologies. Stellar systems could arise in this way. For instance, if you have the cores of two galaxies merging, then one could rotate one way and another could rotate the other way. And if they then merge, you have half the stars going one way and the other half the stars, roughly speaking, the other way. And indeed, such systems have been observed. Now, having seen this, you can ask yourself, what is the basic equation that describes a system like this? And that basic equation, of course, would have to be a dynamic one. In other words, what we have over here, the dynamical equations of motion of the individual particles, would have to be replaced by a similar expression, a time rate of change of the properties of the entire system. So by a quick wipe of the eraser on the blackboard, I have now gone over the orbit of an individual particle, which we had considered so far, to the time rate of change of the overall system. Right? But I still use the same time derivative over here. Well then... The question is, how can we do that? We do this first in a purely formal fashion, right? The probability distribution, the state function over here, the distribution function, is a function of spatial and velocity coordinates. In other words, mathematically we know that the rate of change of any system is given by the sum of the rates of change of the same system for its various coordinates. Now, of course, if we consider this function to to change in time, if we want to make it into a dynamical object, we have to consider the possibility that it will evolve, in which case we have to add a seventh coordinate to the distribution function. Not just simply the distribution in position, the distribution in velocity, but also its behavior, its evolution in the course of time. We then know, just purely from mathematics, that for any number of parameters that a function that this works on is dependent on, we can write a derivative. So, first, the whole thing depends on position, right? So it's the position that changes as a function of time times the gradient in the coordinate direction x. Now, in reality, of course, this is written in three dimensions, in which case you do not write d dx like I do here, but you write the gradient in the x direction. All right? But you will see this. It's notationally complex. I'll just keep it like this. Plus another term, dv by dt times d by dv. Or if you want a momentum coordinate, dp by dt, d by dp. Plus, there's only one third left, and that is the time, dt by dt, partial derivative with respect to time. Now, this is just purely a formal way of doing it. All right. I can replace this whole thing because I already know some of its variables. The time rate of change of the position has a name. We call it the velocity. So we have v d by dx plus. The time rate of change of the velocity has a name. We call it an acceleration, a times d by dv. And the time rate of change of time is unity by definition. So we have plus d by dt partial derivative. In other words, whatever it is we do with f can be expressed by an equation that looks as follows. Df by dt partial plus v df by dx plus a df by dv equals something. Ah, now here's the rub. So far, this is purely a mathematical way of expressing the rate of change of this function f, already knowing that it depends on seven coordinates, one for time, three for position, and three for velocity. In the book, you will get the proper notation, by the way, where all this is sort of given with its proper vectorial behavior and things like that, but I will refrain from that for clarity's reason. Now, fair enough. What are we going to put on the right-hand side? D by dt equals something. What's it going to be? Well, the easiest, of course, would be to say it is zero. What does that mean from the point of view of physics? From the point of view of physics, this means that there are no individual encounters of this type. It is purely a streaming behavior of f, of the distribution function, in space and in velocity in the course of time. This then is sometimes called the collisionless Boltzmann equation. It is better known as the Vlasov equation. Vlasov originally invented this for a different branch of sports, namely for plasma physics, but still. Now you might say, look, this is too trivial, right? It's just really, why write this down? Because then you can sort of already understand that nothing is going to happen that is very interesting in here. But this is not so. Because after all, the distribution function here, this distribution function here comes about because of the sum total of all the particles. In other words, there is a condition over here by which f and the acceleration are connected. I give the total distribution of the particles in space by this distribution function. From that, I can then compute in one way or another, for instance, in the way by this octree or in any other way that you care to mention, I can compute what the acceleration is going to be. But the acceleration itself is part of the equation for F. In other words, the complexity is much bigger than this apparently simple equation would suggest. All right. And that means that even when you neglect the collisions of individual particles, that is to say, either very short-range interactions like this or long-range interactions, such as in the case of the Fokker-Planck equation, even when you neglect that and just simply talk about the overall distribution, there is some hope that reasonable solutions to this equation, to the Vlasov equation, will give you a reasonable expression for the distribution of points in a stellar system. Now, why would this be a more or less realistic expectation? Why is it that we can expect the time evolution of this thing over here to be a comparatively mild thing, right? Because after all, if F changes very quickly in the course of time, such as I have demonstrated with this small computer demo just a moment ago, then this may not be a very useful thing to have. If you have, however, a system of which the distribution function evolves very slowly, then possibly you get something that resembles a long-lived stellar system, such as an elliptical galaxy or a globular cluster. Already from this seemingly simple equation, you can see what is necessary for that. The velocity distribution and the acceleration could be whatever it is in this system, right? Again, the particles could move fast, the potential could be very deep, whatever. However, if these gradients are relatively small, then you can still have an equation that describes a relatively slow evolution of the distribution function. Obviously, if these two terms are very, very small, then df by dt is small also, and therefore you get a slowly evolving system. And that is, of course, what we expect the case to be, because otherwise there wouldn't be such things as elliptical galaxies that have an age of the order of 10 years or something thereabouts. That means, then, that the gradients must be mild. Now, making a weak gradient in velocity space, you do by distributing your velocities very, very widely. So a very broad distribution in velocities. We know that this exists, such as in a gas, for instance, where you have the Boltzmann distribution of velocities, which is a Gaussian distribution, which is relatively wide. And the width of that, of course, is given by the temperature in the case of a gas. And so you might even expect, looking forward now a little bit, you might even expect this sort of temperature to have a certain validity, a certain meaning in a stellar system. It also means that the gradients must be relatively small. Why could gradients in a stellar system be small? Well, that is precisely because the system is collisionless. In the case of a gas, you have shock waves, you have supersonic events, right? You just have an explosion and a shock wave, a very sharp discontinuity with very steep gradients will propagate through the system. In a stellar system, it is as good as impossible to make a shock wave. And the reason for this is that the overall overall distribution is determined by the individual encounters between the particles, and they are rare. So the distribution is very broad, and these gradients are relatively small. So if you leave a stellar system to its own devices, it is not implausible, there's no guarantee, but it is not implausible that under many circumstances, the gradients in velocity and in position are so small that the evolution of the distribution function is also relatively mild and relatively gradual. That is the reason that we have already seen in this seemingly simple equation why certain stellar systems, such as globular clusters and elliptical galaxies, can appear to live in their given form for such a very long time. Now, of course, over and above this, there will be terms here where the situation is different. And we have already seen where we should really point at. It is the individual encounters between particles that will spoil this overall nice distribution. That is to say, then, we will have to have a collision term on the right-hand side. That equation is much more complicated than the Vlasov equation. It is called the Boltzmann equation. And is just about impossible to solve in general. Right? We can have certain properties of it. But again, the self-consistency problem that we have been talking about in the beginning of these lectures is clearly present now and expressed in this equation. And we also know what we need to do. We need to form a reasonable opinion about that collision term over here. And once we've done that, we are maybe on our way to trying to explain why certain stellar systems do what they do.